welcome to the Law Podcast. This week, we are back to our regular format. We have a guest with us who has written a book that's come out just in time for the World Cup. It's called, I always mess up the title of it, Cheers, Jeers, and Tears, the story of England at the World Cup. Joining me to help us interview the author is my co-host and good friend, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Hello, Stephen.
Oh, good evening, Jim. How are we doing?
I'm doing great because my team won the FA Cup today, so I'm pretty happy. Albeit it was kind of an ugly match, but anytime you beat a Jose Mourinho team in kind of a one-off situation, I think you have to be pretty pleased. So I'll
take
it.
Indeed, you do, Jim. You've got to take the successes when they come, Jim.
Yep. And if it is Antonio Conte's last game as manager of Chelsea, then why not go out on top? So.
Exactly. It's a good way to bow out if that's the case. I hope he doesn't. You know, I like the fella. I think he's a fine coach, and he's something a bit different. You know, he's somewhere between Mourinho and the likes of Klopp. You know, that passion's there, and his football isn't as pragmatic as Mourinho. So, you know, I'm glad the way the game panned out today. You know, all rivalries aside, but. Yeah, down with pragmatism.
Well, he definitely did a lot to bring the three center back, positioning back into the Premier League, which I kind of like that. So you know, his tactics were certainly kind of a breath of fresh air, which I think the Premier League was getting a little stale before Conte showed up. So. Bringing that 3-4-3 formation into the Premier League, I think, you know, definitely riled things up a little bit and showed some innovation in a league that needed a little bit of innovation at that point.
Oh, agreed, Jim. Agreed. You know, I think that's the great thing about the Premier League at the minute is that there's a lot of differences and the great differences though. You know, be that the way that Guardiola embraces football and the way that Klopp does and the way that Conte does and others. I mean, you can throw Mourinho into that, you know, is that he's the spanner in the works to some degrees. Is that it's, you know, you have to take your hat off to him. He's so successful in what he does. But at the minute, he's suddenly in a position where, you know, he's going to have to maybe re-image himself if he's going to challenge and to continue or to hold on. We have this new generation of coaches that have come through, and he is going to have to kind of like hold on to them, whereas he's been the pace setter himself for 15 years. That's not quite the case now. So that's going to be fascinating. But yeah, I love the differences between them all. But, you know, we're quite blessed at the minute is that we've got this high propensity of this high density of fine coaches and all very different in their approach to the game. For me, I'd like Conte to stay around, even if it's a case of some musical chairs and he tips up at Arsenal maybe or whatever it is. I like the fella. I think he's great.
Yeah, I'd like to see him stay in the Premier League for sure. Hopefully at Chelsea, but if not, then, you know, if he pops up somewhere else, he pops up somewhere else. But, you know, I like the fact that, just like you said, that, you know, these great managers have this ability to put their stamp, their personality onto a team like Guardiola, like Klopp, like Conte, like Mourinho. And they're so different that you can see the way it's expressed on the pitch. We saw that today very much. You know, Mourinho tried to play that defensive, you know, keep it close, you know, hope for a late goal kind of match, and you know it backfired on him today, and that's gonna that's gonna happen.
It is gonna happen because football's become that bit more expansive, and coaches are having to embrace that, is that you can't possibly close a game down for 90, 95 minutes anymore. You know, there are always going to be chances, you know, created. You really can't just shut a game down in the way that you used to be able to. And that's the fascination of it for me in what happens to Mourinho next, is that, you know, he's going to have to extend himself that little bit more to stay in there. I think, you know, it's a hell of a task to remain completely focused for an entire game and to close oppositions out and you know, curl up into a ball and then break out. It's you know, it's the football of, you know, I'm not saying that pragmatism's over or anything like that. The pragmatism will always come back, but it'll come back in a different form.
Right.
You know,
it will
rise again, but it will be a different pragmatism that rises. And it's a bit like, you know, Arsene Wenger struggling in the way that he has done in recent years with Arsenal, in the way that football has changed to a degree and being left behind somewhat. And then you just get that feeling with Mourinho that he is as well now being left behind to a degree. But it's up to him to prove that wrong and to come back fighting again.
Well, speaking of football changing, I wanted to read a little section of the book we're talking about today just to kick us off, which this is in the first part of the book, and it really struck me about the change between the way football used to be and the way it is today. So I'm going to read this little section to kick us off. And here it says, "Ever the gentleman, wiping his hands on the velvet draped over the royal box to avoid sullying the Queen's pristine gloves with mud from the pitch, Bobby Moore walked up to collect the trophy. A slight but noticeable bow before taking the Jules Rimet trophy in hand, Moore turned and showed the small trophy with his big significance to the crowd. 30 July 1966. What a day that was. It was the day." So with that, I'd like to introduce our guest author today, who's a really good friend of ours, a great friend to These Football Times, a brilliant writer, author of his first book was called I Don't Even Smoke, which is a really personal story that I found very touching, very personal for me, and I really fell in love with it. And I'd like to welcome our good friend, Mr. Gary Thacker. Hello, Gary.
Hi, Jim. How are you doing, matey?
I'm great. And congratulations. I know you're a Chelsea supporter, so we're sort of reveling in the day today a little bit.
Yeah, it's a hands high five across the Atlantic Ocean here, Jim.
Yeah. Well, so that little section of the book, I think, is very much what your writing style is like. It's very much the way this book is written. It's very reverential towards the game of football. I love the way that it's written. You know, you have such a deft hand when you write about football. You know, I'm always touched by your writing. You make it so personal. You know, you really speak to me. You know, you and I are kind of the same generation kind of growing up. And so we have some of the same shared experiences, shared memory kind of thing. So I guess to kick it off, really, what motivated you to write this great book about England and about the World Cup and the way England, you know, has done in the World Cup over the decades?
I guess the short answer to that is I'm not really sure. I almost fell into it. It was at the end of the 2010 World Cup, and I've been over the past couple of years or so, I've been putting articles together that were very World Cup related. And I guess I just saw that there was a story there that I could to tell, that's the how England had failed overwhelmingly in the World Cup, and then they had the moment of triumph. And the title of the book came to me along that way because it's called Cheers, Tears and Jeers, and obviously that's the progression from 66 when they won the World Cup, the Cheers, and there's the Tears, various episodes through the next few tournaments, Gascoigne in Italia 90, David Seaman when he let that free kick from Rondinho float over his head, and then the Gias, because in the last few tournaments, England have become sort of almost perpetual disappointments. We have this crazy thing in this country now where we build up, although this, it's actually not true this time for the Russia one. The hype, I don't know if Steve would agree, evening to you, Steve, as well, by the way, excuse me for not saying hello. I don't know if Steve would agree, but this year, this World Cup doesn't seem as hyped up as the last one. Whether that's true or not, it's just a certain impression I've got. But obviously, so go back to your question. I wanted to tell the tale. I think it's an intriguing story of a country that invented the game, thought they ruled the world with the game, found they didn't, and then they did again, and then they didn't again, and sort of fell away into the pack of ordinary non-successful teams.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. You know, sorry about that, Stephen.
You know, that's
really interesting. You know, the perspective of a country that invented the game, and then sort of, you know, gave it to the world, and then the world sort of took it and got better than they did for a certain time period. And there's a certain irony to that, you know, a certain almost sadness in some ways to that. And some of that kind of comes out in the book, I think. You know, what are your thoughts around sort of that emotional piece of it?
Well, yeah, I think that's true. You know, we did invent the game, and when the World Cup took root in the 1930, we opted out of it because we thought it was beneath this typical English sort of, well, it was obviously the other own countries are part of it as well, that sort of arrogance that, you know, well, you know, they're not really good enough to give us a game and all this sort of thing. And obviously when we had actually joined the throng after the Second World War in 1950, Brazil was the first one we competed in. We found out, as you say, that, you know, the world had took our game, the game that we invented, and put their own individual slants on it. And it was a cold bucket of water over the head moment when England found out that, you know, they didn't rule the world. The first World Cup game they played in 1950, they beat Chile 2-0, and that probably sort of, great, you know, okay, this is all right, we're back and we're going to win this tournament. And then in successive games, they lost to the United States and Spain and didn't qualify. And that was the sort of, what's happening here? What's happened to the world while we weren't paying attention? They've got better, and they had, obviously. And it was an emotional shock for the football fans of the country who'd been led to believe, and it had been sort of spoon-fed by the media, that England were the best, and obviously they weren't. And it took a lot of a lot of changes to get to England back to a situation where they could compete, which they did compete in this sort of in the 60s and even 70s to some extent as well. But it was a real shock, and England had to sort of face a new reality.
Yeah, so Stephen, you were about to ask a question, and I rudely interrupted you, so please go right ahead.
Oh, no. Well, I was going to agree with Gary's assertion that this forthcoming World Cup, there doesn't seem to be, certainly not at this point in time, the hype that has so often gone hand in hand with England World Cup campaigns. I think the last three World Cups have been pretty negative, you know, tournaments as far as England is concerned. I mean, depends what your perspective is. You could say every campaign's negative if you don't win it, but I think there's just been a particular cloud hanging over, you know, every England World Cup campaign since 2006 to a particular degree, is that there just seems to be this kind of, I don't know, like a rut that they're almost in. So that concept of hope that used to be there was always this bandwagon that would go forward, and you can go back to like 1990, and as poor of a World Cup that was, that in England it was built up massively because it was aesthetically pleasing, and England got to the World Cup semi-finals. They came so close, so there was this bandwagon, there was the whole world in motion bandwagon that went on, and all of that. But that whole essence just seems to have been eroded. The whole spirit of the theme has been sucked away somehow, to the point that in a way it might not actually be that bad of a thing, is that England finally look like they can go to a World Cup, not with a load of hope resting on the shoulders, but that people are kind of like just not paying it any attention. And that will do Gareth Southgate and his players, you know, a favour, really. Roy Hodgson downplayed England's hopes so well for 2014 that even in kind of like crashing out in the group stages, no one really blinked. And this is from a country that used to hang effigies of David Beckham because he got sent off in the 1998 World Cup. There was always that basis of the need to be a scapegoat. And suddenly the scapegoats weren't needed because people seemed to care less. You know, the core England fans still care. They still go and they still watch and they travel all over the world and all that. But you come on a garden football fan who would just sit and watch and be invested every 2 years when they reach the finals of a major tournament. It's them that seem to have disconnected from it. And I'd include myself in that. And Dan mentioned it in one of the podcasts as well, is that it doesn't feel like it's my team. It doesn't feel like I'm invested. But I can remember watching England and being fully behind them at previous tournaments and previous eras. And it's a much more complex subject than it appears at face value. You know, as Liverpool fans, we have this epic slogan of "We're not English, we are Scouse." And there is a lot of truth in that, because we don't feel particularly British, we don't feel particularly English, and we don't kind of buy into the whole England ethos. We're a bit embarrassed by it to a degree, is the way that it's supported and the trouble that kicks off across the continent at times. And there's a cringeworthy side to it, which is really, really sad, in that it's that way that the press build it up. So we see it from lots of different directions, the way that the press used to build it up. And you can go back to like Euro 96, and there was you know, war connotations when it came to them playing Germany and things like that. And it's just little things like that that just managed to switch off, you know, a number of light bulbs over a period of time. But I've got to a point now where I'm actually looking at the England team and thinking, I'm quite interested again now, because someone is in charge now that has played international football at a reasonably high level. He played in the semi-finals of Euro 96. And I can understand from a player's perspective, you're looking at Roy Hodgson and things like that and thinking, wow, what is your credentials for telling me how I should play and what is needed from me when you never played at that level? And you know, whereas Gareth Southgate has done. And I think on the sly, he's going to be quite a good England manager. And I think it could be an interesting World Cup. They're not going to win it, but I think they could do a lot better than people think. And in a way, to like how Germany fell out of love with their national team, and then 2006, everything seemed to switch back on again. I can kind of see that happening a little bit with the England team. All it'll take is one little spark and a decent tournament, and then suddenly it will go back 20 years and people will become invested in it again. And I was just interested to know Gary's take on that.
It's a really good point, actually, Stephen. I think there's lots of elements to it. I think the last few tournaments have turned people off, and this is the jeers element of the cheers, tears and jeers. And the last few tournaments are the jeers element, and people have, and they've become numbed almost by the disappointment, the hype, and then the inevitable fall afterwards, and the floating of the golden generations. You know, the that we had this. So there was the era of Beckham, Lampard, Gerrard, you know, and Joe Cole, the midfield four there, and you think, you know, these were exceptionally good players and never actually delivered at a major tournament. And I think one of the things which is very pertinent, which you say about, you know, the Liverpool sort of view of England, you go further north, go to the northeast, and it's even more pronounced because England has become very metropolitan. You know, there's disconnect between the national team and teams that are supported further north. I'd say, especially around Newcastle, Sunderland, Middlesbrough area, they don't see England play. And talk of the of Wembley being sold to the guy who owns owned Fulham and the Jacksonville Jaguars, I think it is in the NFL. And England then going on the road and playing games around the country, very much like other countries do. I mean, Spain play all over Spain in different areas. And I think that then gives the chance to have that connect again, because you're right, Steve, it has been lost.
The old Wembley was knocked down, you had that for a while.
That's right.
That when England went to Munich and won 5-1, for instance, and then, you know, the day that England clawed that draw against Greece at Old Trafford, you know, the England national team was massive at that time, far as the nation was concerned, it's definitely kind of like eroded since New Wembley was kind of like consecrated.
Yeah, you're right, Steve. I think it did help. But it was done because they had no choice. They had to do it. It wasn't a conscious decision. And when the new Wembley was built, and I just talking to Jim earlier, just chatting before you sort of came on connection, the answer to every question is inevitably money. So why are England playing at Wembley, all their games at Wembley? It's because of money. You know, the FA have to make that play.
Yeah,
and you know, that's why you have cup semi-finals there, which takes the edge off FA Cup finals, because they've got to sell the stadium. They've got to make it pay. And if this guy does buy Wembley Stadium and it releases England from that obligation, going around the country again might be a fantastic outcome of something that looks on the surface a bit not welcome. Do you know what I mean?
Mm. Yeah.
Another point, just pick up another point you made, Steve, earlier. I mean, one of the things I noticed when I was working through and, you know, going through all the old records of the World Cups and what happened and the following tournaments and how things developed, you note quite often patterns developing. And in 62, in Chile, Walter Winterbottom, his last tournament as manager, he took a chunk of younger players. And come 1966, those younger players have become a case-hardened internationals. And I'm talking about the likes of Bobby Moore, Charlton, Jimmy Greaves, who actually obviously didn't play so much in 66 because of the injury. But there was five or six players, and they became the core of Alf Ramsey's team. And in 2014, Hodgson did something similar. It took a lot of young players to Brazil. And now you've got players now who are sort of into Gareth Southgate's team, who are, it's not unusual for them now. People like Eric Dyer, Raheem Sterling, these are players now who are young, but they've actually been around the mill a few times as well. So they're not naive in the international game. So, you know, I too am sort of guardedly optimistic that we won't have a terrible disappointment this time and not get out of the group and lose to Panama, or, you know, like we didn't lose to Costa Rica, but we finished bottom of the group to a goal this draw against Costa Rica after losing to Uruguay and Italy and Brazil. So sometimes, you know, it's almost like chalking a tournament off just to get that sort of development for future. Now, I'm sure that isn't planned, but I'll say going through the tournaments, you see patterns repeating themselves. And it's almost like, I'm sure there's no grand design. The FA hasn't got that sort of foresight, but it does happen, and, you know.
Well, yeah, that's the great thing about football, is it repeats itself. Because when people talk about kind of like the history being, you know, a weight around, you know, your neck sometimes, it's not, you know, it depends how you look at it. Is that if you're looking to see the patterns of the past for things that will come in the future. So, you know, people will often say something about, you know, a game or you know, a scenario that's unfolding over the course of a season, and I'll give my point of view of how it will pan out, and sometimes I'll be proved correct. And then I've had that conversation again later in the season, well, how did you see that coming? And it's, well, because it's happened before, you know, and, yeah. And that's the beauty of football, is that nothing is new. It is just upcycled. It is recycled. You know, you are reinventing the wheel time and time again, and the same patterns happen over and over again. So that sense of, you know, the wheel turning and regeneration, and then it becomes stale, and then, you know, the hype comes back, and then it dips back down again. And that happens for everyone, but it just depends on how big the wheel is and how well a team embraces. England have underachieved in that respect. But over that period of time, you can say, you know, how many times have they truly underachieved, or how many tournaments over those years since 1966 could you genuinely say that England might have actually won it had the cards fallen slightly different? And I'd be interested to know where you think England could have won, Gary.
Well, I guess the obvious one is Italia 90. I've always been a big fan of Sir Bobby Robson. I once had the great honour of sitting at the same lunch table with him at as an FA coaches conference in Nottingham many, many years ago. And I just think, I mean, the guy spoke with warmth and knowledge and a passion for the game. And I think he's certainly one of the most outstanding England managers over the time that I've been looking at this. I mean, obviously, Ramsey won it in 66 with the great advantage of playing at home and all the collateral that brings with it. But Italia 90, if we'd have beaten Germany on penalties, not that England would ever beat Germany on penalties, but if we had, I think we would have beaten Argentina in the final, because Argentina weren't anything like the side of 4 years previously. Yeah. So that, you know, a penalty kick away from, you know, we could have won that World Cup. We could have won the World Cup. But I think that's probably the only one where you could say, you know, only say if the cards fell differently, we could have won the World Cup. I think that's probably the only one. And obviously after that, we had the disaster where we didn't qualify.
We spoke about that with Dan.
Yes, I heard the podcast. Yeah,
it's just that's one of those fascinating kind of like twists as well. That turning of the wheel is that to go from a semi-finalist in 1990 to not qualifying in 94. Yeah. Is like a massive, massive step in a short space of time, and again, it's just one of those fascinating kinks and turns. Yeah. But you know, for my two pence, I don't think England were that far away in 82. I think they were, you know, a bolder squad selection away from making the semi-finals, and. Although it wasn't a World Cup, Euro 2004, as I mentioned, you know, I really think they could have. That was kind of like Ericsson's high point.
Yeah.
You know, they were playing good football, scoring plenty of goals. You know, the Rooney bounce was there.
Yeah.
Owen was still you know, firing on all cylinders. Gerrard was up at the top. I think maybe that was the one that Rio Ferdinand missed, wasn't it? You know, had he been there, then maybe it'd be indifferent. And obviously 1970, which has to be, you know, that interest in 1970 is quite huge. That always fascinates me on England's capitulation against West Germany and Lyon, and again, it's those fine dividing lines. You're deflected in one direction from another.
Yeah.
And
I'm old enough to remember 19. Sorry, Steve, forgive me. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go, Gary. Go.
I say, I remember 1970. Obviously, I've been sort of that vintage I remember it being live. And, you know, there again, I think we'd won the World Cup and we were the best team in the world. And that was the belief as we were going into it. But I think if you look at the other teams in that tournament, you know, we lost to Germany and Germany scored a hatful of goals. Absolute hatful of goals in that tournament. Brazil were brilliant. Italy were outstanding. You know, although we didn't perform that badly, I think we could pick four or five teams that were probably going to beat us on any given day anyway in 70. 82 is a different thing. The opening game against France, we played exceptionally well. Ron Greenwood had taken over the managership after the debacle with Don Revie, and it failed the previous time to get them qualified because of the desertion and for Argentina 78. But in 82, we played exceptionally well against France. But then every game from that was a step backwards rather than a step forwards.
For me, what was wrong there was that I've discussed it with a couple of people I know, and the general consensus tends to be that Don Howe's safety first conservatism kind of put a handbrake on Ron Greenwood's, because Greenwood was a great visionary, you know. Yeah. he was a footballing man, and he wanted great beauty in his teams and fluidity and skill and style, and Don Howe was the kind of like the handbrake on that. And there were players that could have gone to that World Cup that didn't. Tony Morley is the striking kind of like anomaly for me there. So brilliant in Aston Villa's league title winning season and in them winning the European Cup in 82. And he didn't even get on the plane. And when you're looking at kind of like the games where you're just looking for something that little bit different to unlock West Germany and Spain in that second group phase, is that he'd have been ideal. But he'd also backed himself into a corner in that when they were chasing that win against Spain, is that Keegan and Brooking were back on the bench. So when he didn't start Glenn Hoddle in the game, there was no way it completely neutralised Hoddle, because if he was going to turn to people on the bench, he was going to turn to Keegan and Brooking. Yeah. So placing Hoddle on the bench that night was basically saying you're going to play no part in this whatsoever, because you're never going to get on the pitch because Keegan and Brooking are going on. So they kind of it was that interesting sense of self-sabotage in a way that it always feels like to me, or often felt like to me, as far as the England team was concerned, the wrong choice just at the imperfect time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was what it was for 82 for me.
Yeah, it's a good point, and I guess they're talking about 82 and players who were selected and weren't fit to start. Brooking and Keegan missed all group games, although England qualified comfortably. Yes. And then you have similar situations where players have been selected. Obviously, you get the metatarsal situation with Beckham, but selecting players that aren't fit, have an injury doubt, shall we say, has come back to bite England on the backside so many times. It happened in Mexico 86 with Brian Robson.
I think the interesting thing with those instances was the way that there'd be this, you know, as you say, the concept of the injured player who wasn't fully fit and would he play, wouldn't he play, or he had a slight injury problem and would it be affected, always seemed to be offset by that that surprise element of the squad that would come through and just excel, you know, take to World Cup football like a duck to water. You know, you could probably point to like Terry Butcher in 82, played no part in the qualifiers yet, was intrinsic into the defence for the finals. Peter Beardsley so memorably came to the fore in 86, as did Peter Reid, you know, and then you had David Platt that basically came from nowhere in 1990. So they always seemed, those England World Cups in particular, those formative World Cups for me, it always had that double-sided coin. You've brought an injured player and he's broken down, but then there's this, you know, this unlikely hero that steps forward, and that's one of the things that the English public have always loved, is the unlikely hero. The underdogs come through, and you know, it's that essence that has been missing for some, and I don't think you can recreate that now, is that football's so all-encompassing, and you know every player is, you know, a laminated Premier League footballer, and that's something that became lost over time. You know, you could point to 98 as maybe being the last of that, where, you know, Paul Scholes kind of emerged from nowhere in the 12 months prior to 98. And I always used to enjoy that element of trying to spot the next surprise in an England squad was one of the things I always used to enjoy watching from my perspective.
Speaking of that, you know, what's kind of the opinion of a guy like Wayne Rooney being, you know, the all-time leading scorer for a country like England? You know, someone sort of unlikely like him being, you know, being that all-time scorer. You know, is that great some people the wrong way, or is he accepted as being one of the greats up there with, you know, Bobby Charlton and the rest?
I guess reverence grows over time. You know, Bobby Charlton's obviously been retired a long time, and I think your sort of reputation gets better as time passes. And perhaps Rooney might be one of these players that's better appreciated, you know, when we missed him for a while. It's a good question, and I think Rooney, if he hadn't quit. If he hadn't said to Southgate, you know, I'm retiring from international football, would he have been selected for the squad? Probably not, but he wouldn't have been a million miles away, because there's a dearth of creative players in the England squad that Southgate's been almost compelled to select, because the pool is fishing and he's quite small. And it's interesting, just going back to the injury issue, just talking about that. He's made a different decision to the one that Bobby Robson made with Brian Robson, and the decision that Ron Greenwood made with Keegan and Brooking. And Wilshere, who's obviously had a number of injuries over time and isn't deemed to be fully fit, hadn't played for England for a number of years, has been left out, and he's gone on the younger. He's gone with form. He's gone with form rather than perceived class, as it were.
And that in itself is a very un-England thing.
It absolutely is.
And I think that's why I'm kind of like just looking at England now at the minute and thinking, actually, it's going to be quite interesting to see how this unfolds. Because he is doing things slightly differently. And he comes at it from a perspective of having been there and done it. And played for England at a period in time where they weren't far off winning a major tournament, you know, in Euro 96. And I just think he has that inside line. And he has so much to prove. And with that added element of the fact that, you know, no one is really kind of like investing themselves, and that hype is low. And I just think they will be one of the interesting sidelines of the next of the 2018 World Cup to keep an eye on, in one way or another.
Yeah, I think another thing he's doing differently. He seems committed to be playing three at the back, which obviously is a fairly modern trend now in the Premiership, in the Premier League, but certainly not with England. I think although Ron Greenwood did it in the home international game against Northern Ireland many years ago, and Bobby Robson flirted with it in Italia 90,
played
against Holland, but then abandoned afterwards. And then the only one other manager who went into a World Cup fairly committed to a back three was Glenn Hoddle in 1998.
He was, and that was interesting as well, is the fact that, you know, for me it's one of those great what ifs. Had Terry Venables continued beyond Euro 96?
Yeah.
And when that was made impossible because they wouldn't meet in the middle, is that Venables wanted the 2-year extension, but the FA were unwilling to give it to him prior to Euro 96. They wanted to see how he did, and then say, right, here's a new 2-year contract. So, you know, neither would play ball. But
there's a classic Mexican standoff with that one.
It was. But Venables bequeathed a cracking side, a great side to Hoddle. Yeah.
Yeah.
He he changed her. You know, he changed the formation, and in a way, Southgate himself suffered on the back of that.
Yeah, yes.
And Steve McManaman was another one. You know, yeah. that he suffered from the change of formation. Yeah. And I think it would have been very interesting to see an England under Terry Venables go to France.
Yeah, well, going back to Venables, do you say about when he left? Because I think it was Noel White, who'd never been a great fan of Venables anyway, but he was committed to him. The FA were committed to employing him because they'd set the great Jimmy Armfield the task of finding a new England manager, and he came up with Venables, and so they were almost hamstrung into doing it because this is what their guy had delivered, and Jimmy Armfield was right because Venables did really well. But he wanted the extension, as you say, and the FA said, well, no, we want to see how we can get on in Euro 96 first. And Venables said, no, I'm not doing that, so I'm going to retire, I'm going to pack in after that. And strange enough, if he'd said, oh, yeah, OK, let's see how we get on, England could have won that tournament, and he would have been the heart of the FA to say, well, I'm sorry, Terry Venables, we're not going to extend your contract because it was a pretty bad tournament for England in Euro 96. So he almost ended up as Venables committing almost managerial suicide because he wasn't going to be given the contract until after the tournament.
I think the interesting thing with that as well is you can see so many parallels with the 1990 World Cup.
Yes.
And from my perspective, from I'd be sceptical over whether Bobby Robson would have got the results and performances out of the players he did in Italy in 1990 and Venables in 96. Had they not been in the situations they were, knowing that they were leaving, because I just think that the shoulders relaxed, you know, they were coming to the end of a line, and it wasn't a case of, well, there's still more to do beyond the end of this tournament. I don't think they'd have done as well as Italia 90 or Euro 96 had either of those managers been in a position where they were going to carry on.
Yeah, it's a good point, Steve. It's a good point. And I think the other sort of implication of that is that, you know, they're allowed to take risks then. It doesn't matter. They can have a gamble on a player. And it's happened, Robson, in Italia 90, obviously because of the Bert Milicic saying, you know, you've got to win the tournament, otherwise you're going to get the sack, and juiced him to go and get a contract in Dutch football. But because he had that freedom, it doesn't matter. He's going to get the sack anyway. His contract's up. And a similar thing happened with Eriksson in his last tournament when he decided to take Theo Walcott. Now, Theo Walcott had played a dozen games, I think, for Southampton. I don't think he actually played a first team game for Arsenal at the time.
It was one of the more peculiar incidents.
But what you're going to do, I mean, so I'm going to do what I think he's going to be. It's a bit of a gamble, but if it works, it works. And if it don't, I'm going to be out of the contract either way. So, I mean, but a lot of countries do this. And I know when we were having the podcasts, when we discussed the 66 and 70 tournaments, how other countries appoint managers specifically for a tournament. And we talked about how Brazil did it and Holland did it in as well. So you get this sort of strange thing where it seems unnatural, but it's also there's lots of benefits you can see, and the manager is free then to do what he wants to do without that sort of consideration of what if it goes wrong, am I going to get the sack?
Yeah, completely. And you can put the, you know, let's say with Walcott as a very, very kind of like pronounced case. But, you know, it's like Alf Ramsey did it in 1970 with Emlyn Hughes and Peter Osgood, you know, 19 or whatever they were at those finals. But also players of immense purpose at the time, and they'd done great things up until that point. And I think the difference with Walcott was that, you know, I don't think anyone had even countenanced that he might be, you know, this great player. He hadn't done it, and there was a huge question mark over it, which has never left his career, to be fair. Boom. You know, he still remains that same question mark now that he was, you know, 12 years ago. But
with Walcott, he had one great game and dined out only for 2 years, the game in Croatia under Capello. I remember from doing the research on this that game for the book and how they played a next qualifier at home. I can't remember who against, but the crowd absolutely cheered to the rafters when his name was announced. He just took off at half time because he'd done a Theo Walcott performance. Just going back to something you mentioned just a few seconds ago about Peter Osgood. I mean, there again, it's another one of those patterns that I've seen throughout and going through the book. It's so many of these maverick players, shall we say, who get end up. I think Peter Osgood got half a dozen caps, which is ridiculous for a guy who, at 19, you're right, and he just finished the league season as the league top scorer.
Yeah, and he just won the FA Cup. He just won the FA Cup.
That's right. And when England were losing to Brazil, and he needed a goal to get pull defeat out of the bag, as it were, a draw out of the bag. He didn't turn to Osgood. He turned to Jeff Hastell instead. But so many players, I say, patterns again, you know, and players like Frank Worthington.
Stan Bowles.
Stan Bowles, Laurie Cunning. Yeah. All these players, you know, who have had, you know, exciting players. And the conservative choice always seems to eliminate their ability to garner the sort of numbers of caps that their talent surely warranted. And, you know, and what would we give now for the tournament now going forward for one of those creative players, outstanding creative players?
Completely. Yeah. I think the interesting thing for that 1970 squad is that, you know, it's that enigma of it, is that they're generally considered a better squad than the team that had won the World Cup 4 years earlier.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people subscribe to that. But at the same time, you know, if you could have transplanted a peak of his powers, Jimmy Greaves, or a peak of his powers, Roger Hunt, which they were in 66, to the 1970 side, then that might have made the difference between success and failure.
You're right.
As well.
Yeah, right. I agree that this is the same.
You also had little kinks like when they went on that acclimatisation tour 12 months earlier, and they went and played at the Azteca against Mexico, and Everton's Gordon West played, and then he refused to go to the World Cup the following year, homesickness or whatever it was, or he just didn't want to spend, you know, a month and a half just sat on the sidelines thinking, I'm not going to get to play. Whereas, and then eventually you have the Benetti incident in the quarterfinals. So, you know, you can transplant that and say, well, had West gone, he'd have gone as the number two, by the look of it, championship winning goalkeeper. You know, how different might that have been, had it been West stepping? No disrespect to Benetti within that. But, you know, if you'd have been thrown in a goalkeeper who had actually played in that altitude 12 months earlier, then it might have been slightly, you know, it might have worked out differently. But that's those great little deflections of how football take it from one direction to another.
Something I covered extensively in the book, that 1970 game against West Germany and particularly the Benetti situation. I mean, as a sort of a loyal Chelsea fan who had a Peter Benetti top for many years, he sort of became the scapegoat for the defeat there.
He was the original England scapegoat.
Yeah. I mean the last goal they scored, I mean, they won three headers. The Germans won three headers in the England penalty area, without an England player actually getting a touch on the ball. And so but it's been harsh on Benetti, and he never played for England again. And he suffered in the situation. I think he only got six caps because he was in a situation where Gordon Banks was such an imperious talent that he was always going to play. So Benetti was shorn of I think he only conceded one goal in these other games he played for England. But was shorn of experience in major tournaments because Banks was always going to be selected. And goalkeeping, obviously, such a pivotal position. And as you say, with the Gordon West situation, perhaps it would have been different. It's one of those things, you know, to discuss over a pint in the pub, isn't it, really, you know, because there's no right answer.
No, but it's one of those, it is one of those great, you know, illusions or mirages, you know. Yeah. Of you know, you can see the outline of what might have been, but it's not there.
Yeah, it's one of the things I've tried to sort of cover in the book that, you know, things that, you know, that might have been different if this had happened, or if this player hadn't been injured, or if this player had been selected for the squad, or if somebody else, you know, if an opponent hadn't done this or scored a penalty or whatever. And there's so many things that can turn a football game. And quite often England seem to get the rough end of it because, you know, it's not fate. Well, I suppose it's fate or luck. There's nothing preordained about it. But he seems there's so many pivotal things that affected England over the years and their sort of aspirations in this tournament. And, you know, I wanted to make the book not a fan's a story. I wanted to make it objective history, and that's why it's called A History of England and the World Cup, rather than you know, my thoughts about England. And there's a lot of books that when I was starting writing that I'd looked at, you know, to give myself a theme and a structure to the book that were very sort of, you know, I think this because of this. But what I tried to do is to make it objective and, you know, just put the facts before people and the situations and let people draw their own conclusions because, you know, it's far difficult to answer questions definitively when there is no definitive answer. It's much easier to put the facts before people and let them, you know, let them consider it. And this is one of the things that I wanted to do. So it wasn't my belief about England. It was the history of it, and let people make their own decisions and conclusions. Because I guess if you get 5 football fans talking about England, you get 17 different opinions anyway.
Indeed, you do.
So, Gary, you know, I had a couple of quick questions here before we knock off. But I know your first book was self-published. This book is not. This one is done through a publisher. Which do you find? Which was the better experience, from your opinion?
Self-publishing was far easier than I thought it was going to be. But one thing you miss with self-publishing is the support that a publishing house gives you. The proofreading, you know, when you've got, I think it's 229,850 words in the book, something of that ilk anyway. And when you go through, you need to reread it and reread it. Your mind has this thing, your eyes see what your mind thinks is going to be there. So it's easy to make mistakes. And reading a book, you know, it's 495 pages. Time and again, it's really difficult. So support of that sort of thing is great. Also, the marketing of the book, it was doing really well on Amazon. A couple of weeks it was launched. In fact, strangely enough, it was at number 40 in the Sport Rugby Union club histories section for some crazy reason. I don't know why it ended up in that. But so they sort of marketed to. I know it's pretty popular on Amazon. It's on Waterstones site, Foyles, WH Smith. So they've got it sort of, the marketing is something that an ordinary guy would find quite difficult to do. So I think the answer is, to your question, is it's far easier with a publisher. And Austin McCauley are really quite helpful. They're not the sort of publisher that says, okay, here's this, go away, come back 3 months later. They're quite interactive with you as well. So I think that was an easier experience than probably a more professional experience than doing the self-publication.
So are you doing any sort of tours to support the book? Are you speaking anywhere, doing that kind of thing?
Well, they are trying to arrange things. Apparently, I mean, obviously. That with their market books, they tend to do it over a long time, so they'll see an active life of books for sort of 2 or 3 years. Now, obviously, the big hit on my book is the World Cup, and you know, when I started writing this three years ago now, I wanted to get it done for the target time to get it finished was Christmas and the start of 2018 to give it a good run up to the World Cup. But, you know, it's a greedy beast and it eats a lot of time. And it actually didn't get finished until March. So I've only got a short window before the World Cup and the marketing there. If England have a great World Cup, it'll probably give it a great boost in sales. If England have a poor World Cup, perhaps not so much. But there again, it's a history thing there. So hopefully it'll keep its currency and they'll market it well. I know they're going to try and set up some book signings, that sort of thing. I guess it'll all depend on how many they sell and who they get interested. I mean, one of the things when I wrote the book, one of my ideas that I wanted to do, you know, you get these sort of milestones in your life. I want to go into Waterstones and see more of my books on the bookshelf. I mean, that would be great.
Yeah, definitely. That would be pretty cool. I know it's always cool to see, you know, to see pictures and things of the magazine that we all work on, you know, and just seeing that tangible, that tactile experience of something you've worked on, you know, so yeah. much, you know, having it be real like that must be pretty amazing to see that in print like that. So yeah.
It's absolutely easy. I remember when I had they delivered me the copies, the file copies of the book, you know, and you want to pick it up and you want to hug it, you know, because it's there's 3 years of my life devoted to it, and I've got a little copy on my desk now. I'm just patting it now because it's my little baby, you know, and I gave it life. And this is one of the things, we're just touching on the self-publication, because it's really difficult for an unpublished author to get a book accepted by a publisher. And that's why I went the self-publication route. But I wanted to give it life. You know, when you work on something for so long, the last thing you want to do is to end up on a memory stick on a computer, and that's where it dies and nobody else ever gets to see it. So, you know, any aspiring author, if you can't get a publishing deal, self-publish on Amazon. It's really easy. And if you want to give your book life, give your book life.
That's remarkable and great advice to those out there with some ideas as well. So I know we've had some of that discussion within our little group, but yeah. So any other pieces of advice you would give to aspiring authors out there?
Yeah, it's funny. There's another one of the TFT writers I've been exchanging a few emails with, and perhaps we can talk about that after we go off air. But yeah, is one piece of advice I'd say is do it. Start it. Because you find a million reasons not to do it if you're not careful. And, you know, I used to have this phrase when I used to manage some design agencies. And, you know, winners find a way and losers find an excuse. And you've got to do it. You've got to get in there. Because if you don't start it, you can't finish it. So believe in yourself. You know, they say everybody's got one book in him. Well, you know, some people have more than one. So get there and give it a go. If you can get help from somebody and a little bit of guidance, get somebody else to read it for you as well. I mean, unfortunately, my wife was very patient and helpful and read through my first book with me several times, because to get somebody else's view on it is always helpful as well. And it's this once you get into the habit of writing, though, it's like a drug. I'm a bit of a book addict now. I get twitchy when I finish the book. It's done now, but I think I've got a plan now to delve into fiction. I've got a structure in my mind for a book about football in Spain, and it's going to be work of fiction. So I think you've got to believe in yourself and you've got to do it. And you know, if people buy the book, fantastic. And if people don't buy the book, at least you give it life.
Well, speaking from my personal experience, I would highly recommend everyone to buy this book, because I just think you're a fabulous writer, and everything that you've written that I've read has been tremendous. You know, I still remember the first article I read that you wrote. It was some ungodly number of words, like 9,000 words or something, about an Eintracht Frankfurt game from the 60s, and I thought, who is this guy? This is incredible.
Oh, bless you, Jim. Yeah, it was that was the story of Eintracht Frankfurt when they lost everybody says the greatest game ever played, when they lost the European Cup final to Real Madrid.
Yeah.
The great Real Madrid side. And well, thank you for that. I mean, I think it's easy to write about something that you love, and you know, I think, you know, yourself and Steve and all the other guys at TFT as well, we all love football, we're all passionate about it, and it makes it easy to write about something that you love.
Oh, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, you just you're one of those very special guys in my eyes, and it's easy for me to endorse what you do. So You know, I'm very, very happy to do that. So, but, you know, anyone who's listening to this, if you love football, then you'll love this book. That's for sure.
That's bless you, Jim. I much appreciate it.
So, Stephen, any parting words for our listeners today? Anything from Merseyside?
No, I'd just echo everything that you've said there, Jim. You know, I've got about 2/3 of the way through the book, and it's a brilliant piece of work, and Gary should be rightly proud of it, as we are, as a collective at these football times. It's brilliant to see one of our own get a book out there, and more to come, hopefully, from Gary and from a selection of TFT writers that can go on and do something similar as well.
That's one thing I love about these football times is the group that we have, you know, that is sort of gravitated to become this group of writers is a really special group of individuals. You know, both of you guys and the rest of the bigger group is, you guys are so selfless and everyone works together for the common goal and there's no jealousy and there's no backbiting. It's everyone is looking out for each other, and it's just such a great group to be around. And you know, I think it's evident when, you know, talking to you guys that you know, we're all in this for the right reasons, and we're all in this together. You know, it's not a competitive. Well, it's competitive, but it's not, you know, in a negative way.
It's competitive in the best way, you know, in the best way possible.
Yeah, it's really special. So I want to thank you both for being integral parts of this great group. So, but Gary, thank you so much, and I've really enjoyed it so far. Like I said, I'm not through with the book yet, but I will be finishing it soon. I hope. I have just been working these crazy, crazy 70, 80-hour weeks lately, and it's really got me on the run. So,
well, I appreciate your kind words, Jim. And you know, settle down, and you know, and when you got time, read through it. I mean, the thing about a book is it's always there; you can pick it up again. And for anybody listening, and just a quick reminder: it's the book's called Cheers, Tears, and Jeers: The History of England and the World Cup. By myself, Gary Thacker. You can search it to find the book on Amazon or any other website. Just plug my name in and you'll probably get directed straight to the book.
Yep, and you can probably also still get his first book as well, which is I Don't Even Smoke. But that one's under your pseudonym of All Blue Days, correct?
That's correct, Jim. Yeah, that was before I came out of the closet and declared my name to the world. Yeah, I started off writing as All Blue Days and still used as my email and my Twitter handle as well. But yeah, this one has got my own name on there, so there's no hiding place now.
That's right. We can all find you somewhere on the coast of Spain to be found. Gary,
that's right.
Living the vagabond life on the coast of Spain.
Too true, Jim, too true. I should be sitting on the balcony typing about football with a glass of Merlot in my hand and the sunshine down.
that's the life, brother. That's the life. You deserve it.
Bless you, Jim. Thank you.
All right. So thank you. Thank you both for this wonderful hour of conversation. And thank you all for listening to this. I am Jim Hart. This has been the Lob Podcast. And we hope to have you tune in once again. We will be continuing with a couple more episodes of World Cup, Stephen and I hosting that. And then we'll probably take a little break while the actual World Cup is going on, since everyone will have their focus on that for a month. But then we'll be back. We're going to be changing up some things and coming back with a weekly podcast. With lots of new stuff starting after the World Cup, so keep on the lookout for that. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.